Hello and welcome back to Fade In, a podcast from the club Screenwriting at Victoria College at the University of Toronto, where we take a critical look at film storytelling. Today we'll be discussing Next of Kin, the debut feature-length film of prominent Canadian filmmaker and UFT alumnus Adam Egoyan, first released in 1984. Egoyan was born in Cairo in 1960 to Armenian-Egyptian parents. Soon after, his family immigrated to Victoria, British Columbia. During his adolescence, Egoyan developed his passion for film. He attended Trinity College at U of T, and after graduating, embarked on his early career in filmmaking. Next of Kin, the first installment in Egoyan's impressive filmography, won the Genie Award for Best Picture, later renamed the Canadian Screen Award, soon after its release. Egoyan would go on to receive much critical acclaim for his psychologically captivating independent films. His 1997 film The Sweet Hereafter, based on the Russell Banks novel of the same name, received two Academy Award nominations, among many other accolades and recognitions at Cannes and at the aforementioned Genie Awards. Next of Kin follows a young, troubled man named Peter Foster, who lives in an unhappy home environment with his parents. After happening upon a videotape recording of an Armenian immigrant family's therapy session, Peter decides to impersonate the family's long-lost son, whom they gave up for adoption years prior, and through his involvement with the Darien family, helped to resolve their deep-seated conflicts. I'll be joined by our VP Finance, Marta Nielska, along with an associate editor for our club's journal, Sophie Abousali, to discuss Egoyan's feature film. Together, we'll consider how Next of Kin approaches subjects such as ethnic and cultural representation, the benefits of an unconventional cinematic and storytelling approach, and how Egoyan attempts to evoke genuine emotion from his audience through the film's unique presentation and substance. Whether you're a dedicated Adam Egoyan fan or someone looking to learn more about him, we hope you'll find our discussion in this episode insightful. We hope you enjoy listening, and it goes without saying, but true blue. I'm joined now by our VP Finance, Marta Nielska, and an associate editor of our journal publication, Screenwriters Perspectives, Sophie Abousali. Marta, Sophie, how are you both doing?
I'm good. Yep, I'm doing good too, thanks.
Excellent. I'm really excited to discuss Next of Kin with you both, not the least of which because it's a film by a U of T alumnus, so we're staying on brand, I guess, with our school association with this podcast. And it's just an interesting film that I was not aware of until, Sophie, you brought it to our attention. So I'd love to dive into this. But first, I'm just curious to hear from you, Sophie. When did you first discover this film and what interested you about it upon first watching it?
Yeah, so I first discovered it in my first film class at Innes. And because my professor was like obsessed with Adam Egoyan films, so he sort of like shoved them down our throat. But Next of Kin was, I wasn't aware of that movie either until he screened it in class. And I remember just feeling so like eerily attached to it because I think it was the first time that like I've ever seen myself reflected on a screen.
Mm-hmm. Referring to the Armenian characters represented.
Yeah, well, I'm not Armenian, but I think part of me questioned whether or not entertaining film could feature people like me as its like main characters until I saw that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to start off here, because you know, one of the many values that you pointed out about the film is that it represents underrepresented characters, but in a way that doesn't strip them of their complexity, as you also wrote in your to be published analysis for our journal. So I think maybe that's a great place to start there. Sophie, what do you think makes the Armenian characters in this film so compelling? And how does that, you know, differ from mainstream film representation?
Yeah, so my first thought when watching the movie was like, as soon as it finished, I was like, the guy who wrote this had to have experienced it. Like, there's always a difference, I feel like I can tell when someone's writing from a place of experience versus like imagination. And when I Googled it, like he was, and it was so obvious because of how empathetic the screenwriting was. No characters were flattened. And typically whenever you see minority characters, it's like a side story and it's very stereotypical, but I think he did a really good job at showing these characters as like full people bad and good, and but also in a non-judgmental way.
Was there a particular character in that regard that stood out to you just as an example of showing them in their fullness?
Yeah, I guess George, because Adam McGoyan really uses Peter as this tool for the audience to explore all the different facets of the same characters, because they change when they're around each other. And so George has a lot of fullness to him for someone who started out in the movie as only being shown a very bad side too.
Yeah, I'll note that I was like similarly impressed by kind of this frame narrative that allowed like us to step into this world of something that, like, again, is not my culture. I'm not Middle Eastern, but that is more recognizable to me than the typical like kind of nuclear North American family. It felt really real to have, like, especially like the birthday party scene at the very end. It felt very real to have like this massive family that are all kind of like yelling and ramped up. There was something about that I thought was really cool. The idea of like entering that space from a North American perspective and getting to explore it in a way that was really, like really humanizing and really respectful towards the culture and treated it as something that was like worth exploring beyond what is typically a Western experience. I found that really appealing because I don't usually see that on screen. I don't usually see situations in which like those kind of like Middle Eastern family dynamics or like Eastern European family dynamics are treated as a real and valuable and like positive alternative to the classical North American or Western European family. So I too like also connected with it in a different way. It felt, yeah, that experience felt true to me and felt like very solid to me as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought up the final birthday scene, Marta, because I didn't realize this upon rewatching the film, because I watched it a few times. And I think it was just so deliberately made to contrast the earlier birthday scene before Peter assumes this identity as Bedros. And he's just, you know, with his parents, they have a cake. It's on the surface, it's the same situation. But in the earlier example, it's sort of sad. You know, he's with these parents that don't get along. He's not really enjoying himself. And then when you go to the later scene, when it's the entire Darian family and all their relations, and they're just so raucous and enjoying themselves, and there's all this camaraderie and joy, I think it really brings together Peter's journey throughout the film by showing how it differs in the external circumstances he finds himself in. So that was definitely an aspect that resonated with me in terms of the writing.
When I rewatched the film for this, what I didn't notice beforehand, like you were saying, was there is a line, I believe by Sonia to Peter, where she asked him about his parents, since they think that he's been adopted. And he says, they're not emotional. And she says, oh, well, they're not like us. And at first, when I first watched the movie, the only thing that I thought it was commenting on was like, this like cultural like and social pull in this family and their experience. I didn't realize that it could have also been commenting on Peter's family experience.
Mm-hmm. So sort of the comparison and contrast between the Fosters and the Darians that sort of bring out those differences.
I think there's also like this film is like so odd at times. I think there's a type of comedy to it where I contrast that very first birthday scene where you're just like stuck on this shot of this man blowing out candles for like what it feels like 5 minutes and you're like, man, just get to it already. Like, you can do it. I believe in you. And then at the end, you get the same kind of birthday scene, but this time they're like, you got to blow them out all at one time. And there's like so much more energy to it and everything. I think it's like, it's like so pleasant. I think this is like not, I was shocked at how like non-traditional the movie was in terms of like, well, he never tells them he's lying. Like, it was so funny. It was like, I'll just slip into this reality that's not mine. I guess that's fine. I think there's a part of me that like wants to pull back and be like, okay, but like 30 years down the line, are they gonna find out like what happens? I think like that was a like I don't know, there's a kind of comedy to this movie that I enjoyed that's highlighted even by those more emotional scenes, like the candle blowing out.
Oh, no, definitely. We brought this up in class before as well, because it was like, it feels like a movie that shouldn't like have comedy at some points, but like also just the sheer fact that like this family believes that this like white boy is their son and he clearly doesn't look like any of them.
It was a bit hard to stomach that. I think you have to like be willing to forego a lot of scrutiny there.
I found that so funny. I was like, this is perfect. This is like so good. The how they keep being like, oh, he looks just like me. It was like, this is so good. Yeah. This is like the height of comedy. I also really like, I think it, when I was thinking about it, I was like, it might also just speak to their like psychological state that they're willing to accept this white boy as their child. They're like, we're in a really bad place. We just need a white boy apparently to be our child. Like, we just need anything. And I think that also highlights a kind of emotional undertone, like the emotional undertones to the movie. I feel like that could also like allow us to maybe acknowledge like the kind of like what is acting dimension to the film, and kind of like what is pretending, is this character pretending, is he not pretending, and what does that mean? Because I also found that really interesting.
And just to circle back to an earlier point you made, Marta, in terms of the film defying sort of the conventions you would expect through that use of comedy, I think it's equally so when it comes to the fact that, as you say, Peter never reveals his facade to the family, you know, whereas, you know, in a typical film, you'd might expect this revelation to happen at a scene like the birthday party at the end. And for a second, I thought that that was where it was going to head, but it just ends on this somewhat ambiguous note, almost as if Peter is continuing his performance, you know, continuing that acting well beyond the runtime. So I'd be curious to get both of your thoughts on that aspect.
I did think it was going to be revealed eventually, and I was slightly shocked that it wasn't, but I also thought that it was in line with Peter's character probably to not. I wasn't exactly relying on him to make that move, but I do kind of like that it was open-ended in that sense, just because I feel like I really like his dynamic with the family, and so the idea of it continuing past the runtime makes me kind of happy.
Yeah, I think this is kind of what stops it from being like what I would expect a conventional movie act to be like. Like, I'm thinking how much less I would like this movie if it went like, character does crazy shenanigan and tricks a family into thinking that he's their long lost son. At one point, there's a climactic scene, blah, 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 blah. I think about that and I'm like, I think I would find that boring. I think that sounds kind of like an Adam Sandler movie. I don't want to watch that. But this way, I feel like it makes me want to watch it. Another thing that like is maybe tangentially connected to this is I like the end where the psychologist is like, so how does this make you feel to his parents? I found that really interesting with regards to like where they're left in this whole like story and kind of like what it means for them to like be abandoned essentially by their son. Like, their son is like, well, I'm gonna choose a different family, thanks, have a nice life, like it was good knowing you. And I think that's like such a preposterous, absurd ending for the movie to take on, that I think it almost works perfectly with the premise, which like when I first realized what was happening or what they were gonna do, I was like, what? You're really going for this, aren't you? So yeah, I think it fit pretty well with what I think was already a pretty preposterous concept.
Well, speaking of that concept, I mean, the idea of, I'm not nearly as well versed in this as I should be, but the idea of recording therapy sessions for like counseling purposes, I'm not sure if that's something that's been practiced widely. I mean, keep in mind, this was,
I feel like that's not legal. I'm pretty sure that's not legal.
I just want to make sure, in case this might have been something that people did. Then again, this was the 80s. So like, yeah, I'm wondering, is this like just liberty on the part of the film? Is there like something based on it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't know if that's because this was filmed in 1984 and maybe it was legal then, but I am very, very sure it is not legal now.
So Sophie, I assume by that you don't mean like 1984, like Big Brother is watching. No, you mean it's okay.
Like the actual year of the movie. That's ironic though.
This is the other reason I kind of liked the movie, was because even like the way it was shot and the way everything was done, it reminds me of like those unethical psychological practices from the 80s. Like I'm thinking of like the Stanford Prison Experiment, wherein they like, you know, push their like participants to the brink of like becoming prisoners and abusers. And it's like, maybe this shouldn't be how you do things. I think like the entire quality of like watching through the TV screen and all of that was very reminiscent of almost like this, like, I don't know how to, and the music too, that like recurring kind of theme song that they had in the background was very reminiscent to me of like an old psychological practice or an ethical experiment, which when you think about it, I guess that's kind of what the movie is. Like the guy essentially goes, what if I did this thing? What if I like pretended to be someone's long lost son in order to see if I could like help them, even though I have no credentials and like I'm 23. I've never done anything like this. And I think like, when you think about it, it is like, he's just playing around, at least at first. He's just playing around. He's just seeing what he can do.
Yeah. I also think, like, I also don't think that a therapist would legitimately go up to one of his patients and say, hit me, George.
You never know these days.
That's true. But, yeah, no, I think that's like a really good lead into like questioning like Peter's methods and whether or not obviously whether or not they're ethical, but also like for the sake of himself, he like is psychologically like deeply exploring himself, but in some of his like when he's recording to himself and his own dialogue in sort of a dangerous way, because he talks about getting lost in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's definitely interesting to psychoanalyze Peter in this way, despite the fact that he himself likes to psychoanalyze others. It was an interesting case. I'm not quite sure I know what to make of it, but I'd love to hear both of your thoughts, because I think there's a lot of ambiguity and complexity there.
Well, I feel like Peter, obviously, at the beginning of the movie, he's almost like in a state of like a static state where he's not moving, he's not going forward, and he says he likes to pretend to be other people, which I think is interesting with regards to like the fake it till you make it Shakespeare mentality of like the whole world is a stage, you know. I think like with regards to his decision to kind of like see if he can help himself by adopting this persona and adopting this life that is like not his, he allows himself to explore possibilities for happiness, and those possibilities end up being something that appeal to him. I would wonder, like, I wonder, I guess, what both of you think about whether is Peter the same person at the beginning of the movie as he is at the end of the movie, both like kind of literally, but also performance wise. Also, I am wondering what you make of that. I think it's like the third shot of the film where he like jumps into the pool and then he comes up on the side and he does like a model pose. I just found that so funny. I keep laughing on this episode, but it's just because like there's so much about this movie that I think about and I'm like, I think I must have been dreaming. Like I must have not seen that correctly. I don't know what you both think about that.
I mean, I'll just respond to that second point because I think maybe it's the easier one. I thought it was like somewhat foreshadowing for like in the midpoint of the film where he lies on the Darien family's dinner table and Sonia put his arms around them. That's the way I connected it in my brain. But I agree, it seemed like a bit of an oddity, I think, at first, Marta, when he was by the pool.
I'm don't know. I think he was odd from the very beginning. Like, I mean, the first shot is like luggage, right? And I think the second shot is him in his bedroom. And he's like, he just like wakes up and like starts playing like the air guitar or something. And his like mom comes in. And like, you can tell right from the beginning that this guy is so performative already. So I feel like it suits his character very well, but like, you can tell that like, he is very performative right from the start.
But then like, the funny thing is that the longer, like, I feel like in the beginning of the movie and in the middle of the movie, I'm like convinced. I'm like, okay, this guy might be a good actor. He might know what he's doing. Like, you know, he kind of inserts himself into these people's lives. He like asks them questions that make them think a lot. He's really effective, I think, in that way. And maybe that's because that is him. But then towards the end of the movie, like especially in the birthday scene, I found his performance really awkward. Like almost like he didn't know what to do when he had to be a real person who was being shown kindness to. Like, I feel like there's almost a sense that the Peter at the beginning of the movie is more comfortable because he is performing, and because like that Peter might not be a quote-unquote real Peter that is like that shows anything of himself or is vulnerable in any way. But the Peter at the end of the movie is like more uncomfortable and like more not sure of himself because he's having to interact in an environment where he really feels like he can be himself, but he doesn't even know how to do that.
Yeah, that is a really interesting point that you brought up, because like we mentioned earlier, that like one line where he says that his family is not emotional. I think it's really interesting that you brought up the fact that he almost has this like freedom to be in himself, but he's like uncomfortable with being like showed that level of affection. Could be like commenting on sort of like the emotional distance that he's experienced in his family beforehand. And perhaps that is why performing is so much more comfortable for him.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of somewhat related to that, again, the whole end birthday scene. I'm curious to hear what both of you made of the directorial decisions there. We've talked about, of course, like the writing and how it might, you know, serve Peter's character. But what I noticed was like when he was giving that, you know, awkward rambling toast speech there, the camera was far more focused on the idle chatter with the guests and the relatives and sort of going around the room and focusing on them. And I thought that, you know, again, I thought it was leading to some sort of revelation that Peter was going to make, but that didn't happen. But, you know, more to that point, I thought so that, you know, emphasizing all these guests was somehow a way to signal that maybe Peter didn't belong in this community and that they were sort of not completely paying attention to him or something. But I don't know, I was thrown off guard a bit by that directorial decision. So I'm curious to hear what both of you make of it.
Well, I think there is a bit of a dissonance with regards to like what Peter interprets as family versus what this traditional Armenian family interprets as family. Because if you listen to his words at the end, he has kind of a revelation. He's talking about how he never felt like he really fit in his family and how it seems really ridiculous to him that you just end up with the family you end up with and that you can't really form real relationships with those people because there's always that kind of barrier of like, you are family and therefore you have a certain relationship to each other that is already pre-established. And he feels like he's broken out of that, and that's what allows him to like feel comfortable in this family. But for these other people, that's absolutely not the case. They feel comfortable here exactly because of the fact that they were born into this family and because that's who they've been with their entire lives. There's a dissonance of interpretation there. They're not listening to him, but I don't think it's because they don't care about him. I think it's because it's exemplifying the very fact he's talking about, which is kind of like that they already have a pre-established relationship to him wherein like they will care for him kind of no matter what he says. Like, it doesn't really matter. And I think that's both sad and comforting. Like, I think it's comforting to see how they all cheer for him at the end, regardless of whether they were listening or not. I also think there's a kind of cheerfulness in them having conversations with each other, even while he's talking. Like, there is connection there. It just shows how, like, Peter values and gets something else from this family than other people do. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. It's just something that the director is potentially trying to show us.
While Egoyan's film showcases the significance of drama therapy in a fictional context, this is just as true for the real-world clinical practice. On this week's installment of Newsreel, we wanted to earmark a related celebration taking place in Iran this week. According to the Tehran Times, the country's leading international daily news publication, Iran will be celebrating International Drama Therapy Week during several special programs, which will begin on Tuesday, October 19th. The programs have been planned by the Drama Therapy Center of Iran, in collaboration with the Dramatic Arts Center and the Iranian Association of Dramatic Arts. The International Drama Therapy Week is observed every year in 104 different countries, which are all members of the World Alliance of Drama Therapy. Moreover, with TIFF having recently wrapped up, and our discussion on Adam Egoyan as a Canadian filmmaker who promotes diversity and portrayals of the immigrant experience in his works, we wanted to highlight some prominent up-and-coming Canadian filmmakers of color who were featured at the festival this year. Some audience favorites included the political dark comedy Defund, co-starring and co-written by Toronto-raised and Surinamese-born Khadija Roberts-Abdullah and Ethiopian-Canadian Araya Magesha, who portrayed two millennial twins witnessing the growth of the Black Lives Matter movement while stuck in quarantine together. In addition, two Pakistani-Canadian filmmakers garnered attention for their unique portrayals of their cultural background. The Karachi-born Hamza Bangash's short film Bai, about the relationship between two brothers in the filmmaker's home city, and Haya Wasim's film Quickening, a coming-of-age story centering on the Pakistani-Canadian girl's journey navigating two different cultural worlds. Finally, one festival film which struck a local chord was Scarborough, adapted from Catherine Hernandez's novel of the same name, which chronicles the struggle of three low-income minority communities in the East Toronto suburbs. For more information on these filmmakers and events, check out the links in our episode description. But that's all for this week's Newsreel. Now, back to the show.
I definitely remember, I didn't watch this today, sorry, but I definitely remember that last scene. I do remember finding it odd, the lack of focus on him, but I did feel a sense of cohesion, which is, I think, what he was trying to portray. I'm not sure, but that is how it felt to me, is it felt very cohesive for that family to be together. And I think it was it panning around the room or something? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was right after we had the wonderful hands out of the cake moment. So definitely taking a lot of visual creativity there.
Also note that this is extended family. I don't know how close y'all are to your extended family, but it's a different kind of vibe. Peter's made connections to the rest of the family. He's had impactful moments with Sonia, George, and Aza, and I think that's kind of enough. I don't know if family is that straightforward, if that makes sense. I don't know if everyone needs to have a deep, impactful connection constantly in order for it to be meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that just speaks to your earlier point there, Marta. And since you brought up Peter's individual relationships with each of the three family members, maybe that's something we can also dive into. Maybe because the one I found the most interesting, the relationship between Peter and George, which it was definitely, something that seemed quite familiar, fathers love their sons, especially for, those of us of a first or second immigrant generation background. So nothing surprising there, but I think it was also sort of, at least to me, surprising how open George was to just accepting him. Because as we acknowledged, we can overlook the fact that he doesn't exactly look the part, Peter, shall we say. But then George is just willing to accept it. Sure, we'll buy that. But then the fact that, this is a son that you haven't had any relationship with for 20 years, and George just immediately attaches himself, onto Peter, which is wonderful and wholesome on the one hand, but also somewhat, intriguing and maybe reveals more about George's character on the other hand. So I'd love to get both of your thoughts on that relationship.
I think maybe that attachment is really interesting. I think that it makes sense since Peter is sort of playing therapist in this role, Because in a way, I do think it may be easier to attach yourself to somebody that you don't already have a pre-established relationship with, because what George has with Peter is imagined up until the point where he is introduced to the person who isn't really his son, but who is playing his son. And the mother says that he like can't sleep at night sometimes because he's wondering like where he is, what he's doing and things like that. So I do think that he is like very desperate for like that sort of idealized connection, probably even more so in light of his fighting with Azza. It's probably making him seek that out more.
I mean, to add on to that, I don't know if it's that strange. Like, I'm not a parent. I assume neither of you are, although I don't want to assume too much.
You can assume, I think. It's all right.
Yeah, I will assume you're both not parents. And I'll say that, like, I actually don't know if it's, like, I'm thinking of, like, what my dad would say, for example, in this situation. And I think, like, if there's a kind of bond between a parent and their child where, like, you're immediately willing to establish that connection. I think this, again, plays into the kind of balance that we were talking about earlier, where it's, like, choosing your family versus having your family. Like, again, I think when Peter is coming into this, choosing his family, right? Like, that's his interpretation of it, which, again, outlines that dissonance, because George is not choosing him. George thinks that this is his family, and for him, that established connection exists, which makes you kind of, I think if you were to think about it differently, it would make you reinterpret a lot of the events of the movie, because we look at it as just kind of this guy walking into this family's life, but George looks at it as something different. I think there's a level of credibility that is afforded to Peter from George because of the fact that he's his son, and that's something that matters. That is something that gives Peter some level of authority already. And on top of that, I think it gives him more authority again than Azza, because there's a different way you treat people you've known your entire life, especially if you've known them as children. Like, there are things we do as children that makes you kind of like, he looks at Azza as a child. That's like kind of the main conflict they have to get over in the movie, but he's never known Peter as a child. So that's kind of another layer to that connection, even though it's pre-established and it grants him authority. He has more authority even than Azza, for example, who's also the child, because George has never experienced him as a child. So that doesn't even really exist in his imagination or in his conception of Peter.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the relationship between George and Azza. I'd also like to hear both of your takes on maybe a simplistic question, but why there exists so much tension between those two characters. Is it just the idea of growing pains as a parent, watching your child move on from you? Or is there something underneath there that maybe I missed?
I did write about in the analysis. One of the biggest things that stuck out to me is, like, we say, like, this traditional Armenian family, but I think that George and Azza sort of act as mirrors to each other. And the reason that I say that is because they actually have a lot in common. They are both, you hear George's backstory and you hear Azza's backstory. They are both rather progressive for their backstory, which is interesting considering that George is struggling to, like, loosen the restraints on Azza, but they both also have a lot of pride. And so that pride is sort of in between them what prevents that sense of emotional connection, even though they do reflect each other.
I'd love to hear a little bit more, Sophie, if you don't mind. When you say in terms of their backstories, maybe especially because of George, because I'm sort of intrigued by this take here, in what ways do you think he is a little more progressive because of events in the past?
Well, he talks about how he used to have a lot of money and he would bribe everyone. And then he moved. I can't remember the reason why. I don't remember the reason why he stated, but he moved and he had nothing when he moved. And he did that because everything he earned filled him with pride, even though he gave up having a sense of, like, authority and control in his, like, previous status. And then Azza is, she talks about being an artist and how she's, like, drawing or painting, like, a naked model's body, and her father found out and got really mad at her.
I could just picture that scene. It's a shame we didn't get to see it in a flashback or something. But oh boy, yeah, that was definitely character revealing trait there.
The other thing I'll note, I guess, is I think, like, I don't know if this feels relatable to other first generation, like, people in North America who have, like, immigrant parents from those kinds of backgrounds. But yeah, that seems pretty accurate to me, like, personally, like, those kinds of tensions exist. I think, like, maybe it has a certain dimension between, like, people who are, like, daughters and fathers specifically. I think there is kind of, like, I think it is growing pains, like, to some extent. I think there's a moment in every parent's life where they kind of have to realize, oh, you're, like, a real actual person with actual thoughts, and they might brush up against mine, and I have to be okay with that. I can't generalize for all Armenians or anything, but this is something I've had conversations with people about from, like, the Middle East, but also from Eastern Europe and other places like that. Like, there is this kind of cultural deference to your family, this kind of belief that you owe something to your parents. I don't think it's like, that sounds, I think maybe a little bit harsh for North Americans, but I do think that's just how it is in some cultures. And on top of that, I want to note that I think the solution is pretty accurate to real life, in which, like, Peter tells Azza to act. And it's not necessarily like faking it, it's compromising for the sake of someone you love. I think that's pretty accurate. I think that's part of becoming an adult, like, from being a teenager to being an adult. I think part of, like, maintaining a good relationship with your parents is, like, compromising to some extent, and, like, kind of figuring out at least ways to appease them, or making them feel like, treating them as people, essentially. You do that for other people, you do that for your friends, you compromise for your friends, and you compromise for other people in your life. I think it is fair to say that, like, part of the process of, like, having a good relationship with your parents is, to a reasonable extent, of course, doing the same for them and paying the same respect to them.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting that you brought that up, Marta, because I did, I believe, quote that specific line when she's like, I feel like I would be lying. And he says, not if you think about the reason why you're doing it, because you love him. Which I do think it's interesting, because he is acting for, like, almost the entire movie. And he talks about the difference between lying and acting, or lying and performing, but performance, like, is a lie. However, we buy into performance because we want to believe the lie. People buy into acting and performance in an attempt to escape their own reality, which I think is something that all the characters are doing, you know, Peter and the family included.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's so effective in terms of structure this movie is how Peter's relationship with his adopted family, I guess we could call it, so markedly contrasts that with his own family. And, you know, those dynamics of parental relationships that you were talking about earlier, Marta, for the Darien family, seem to be miles apart from how the Foster family interacts with Peter. And that level of deference and respect that we see in the former is not quite there in the latter. And maybe that was what, you know, Peter was missing in terms of his development. So I think that was definitely an interesting contrast.
I think, like, maybe this conclusion is the same one that Peter comes to at the end of the movie. If him being with his family, his, like, actual family, is real, quote unquote, is the truth, then, like, what is its value over the quote unquote lie or performance? Like, obviously, I guess there's something to be said about, you know, realizing harsh realities or accepting harsh realities. But I guess, like, what's the point if you don't have to? Like, why not create a nice fiction if it's not hurting anyone? I guess is kind of the question. If it's in fact helping people, what bothers us so intensely about creating a kind fiction? And I guess this is a question to throw out to you, because I don't think that the movie actually bothers to come up with a conclusion for this. What are the stakes here? What, the movie doesn't really engage with that, unless you count George's heart attack as one of them. Like, what is the harm in this, like, pretty lie?
I think one of the few things the movie engages with in terms of consequences is Peter scaring himself when he talks about, like, the loss of his own identity within this performance and how he can't tell anymore when he is acting and the opposite, you know? But I think that, like, we were talking about how they didn't reveal him to not be their son in the movie. And I think that if they were to, it would have been so much more, like, heartbreaking to see, because the movie does sort of focus on how he can push forth, like, this progression within the family. So I think it was a good choice not to engage with that, just because you're already dealing with, like, I feel like in movies, in, like, a traditional sense, introduce conflict, we're shown conflict, like, right off the bat. And so the movie is sort of moving towards a sense of resolution rather than, like, introduction, conflict, then resolution. It's all about sort of making peace between these people. And I feel like to have revealed that would have done the opposite of what feels like the purpose of the movie.
And I guess I wonder too how that fits into the euphemism of the movie of, like, Peter taking a vacation and all the suitcase motifs and stuff. I think that that's interesting in context, because the idea is, like, I guess, is that this vacation isn't real. It's a vacation. It's temporary. It doesn't count as reality. But, like, what makes me going to Cuba for a weekend less real, like, than my quote-unquote real life? Like, is that separation kind of arbitrary, is what I'm trying to say? Is the separation between, like, vacation and whatever is not vacation, I'm blanking on a word here for the opposite of vacation, but is, like, whatever barrier between that arbitrary? Because if it is arbitrary, if I go to Italy tomorrow for a week and then I stay in Italy for a week and I'm like, you know what, I kind of just don't want to leave. Like, I could do that. And if I do that, don't I just live in Italy? Like, if I just go on vacation to Italy, but then I'm like, I don't want to leave and I stay in Italy and I get a job in Italy and I, like, have a family in Italy, don't I just live in Italy at that point? Like, what is that separation? I think that's quite funny, actually.
Yes, you do just live in Italy at that point. I think that the separation is, like, solely in the fact that he is pretending to be somebody he's not. And he is, like, interfering in a family's life that, like, isn't his. And I think that if they were to know that, or if, like, again, if that were revealed anyway, it would move from, like, this sort of, like, sweet meaning thing to something that feels very invasive and not his place.
Mm-hmm. And I think the whole question you raised there, Marta, also gears us in the direction of how we can approach the film and its intents more broadly. So, Sophie, I know one of the points you brought up, both in your analysis and your notes, was how the movie itself can be a form of dramatic therapy. You know, the movie features a lot of scenes of therapy, but in itself perhaps can be therapeutic for viewers in terms of maybe allowing some of that escapism that Peter indulges in order to navigate your conflicts and come to terms with them. I'm just curious to hear both of your takes on that value of the film in general.
Yeah, for sure. The thing that stuck out to me the most, because a lot of people don't even know, like, it exists, is that drama therapy is an actual practice, and it's the practice of using acting essentially to psychologically and emotionally explore yourself and your relationships with other people. And they utilize that tool a lot in the film. And the very fact that it's a film that does explore things psychologically and can be a form of escapism is, like, cinema therapy in a sense, especially given in, like, regards to that it is representing, like, underrepresented people. At least for me, like, I think that was my first time ever being able to, like I said, fully see myself reflected on a screen. And the amount that I got sucked into the story versus the amount that I get sucked into, like, a Marvel movie, for example, very, very different. It was much more personal.
Why does it always come back to Marvel movies on this podcast for references?
Because you guys brought it up earlier.
It's just the go-to, like, God damn it, this is where our culture is at movie. Like, it's just like, I feel like maybe 20 years ago it would have been Star Wars or like Harry Potter or something. Today it's Marvel.
Well, we'll get to that in future episodes. We will, in good time.
Yeah, but I think that, like, again, it's interesting because, like, under the particular conditions, like, to what extent is it drama therapy? Because again, as you noted, Sophie, in response to my is the separation arbitrary between like Peter's vacation and his reality? And the answer is like no. And the answer is no, because you're right, he engages with other people. That's kind of the problem. The problem is that it's not just a lie he's telling himself. It's not just like him coming into an identity. It's him lying to other people, and that adds stakes to it. And so I wonder if that same way, like, does that progress actually, like, does that drama therapy become trauma if you find out it was a lie? Like, if in the future they find out it's a lie, does that actually become a traumatic event for them? Moreover, like, to what extent does Peter actually become their son? Like, to what extent does the lie block the identity of Peter as their son from becoming a reality? Again, kind of like, if you figuratively think of Peter's existence as their son as like his stay in Italy and then him just staying in Italy, to what extent does that like connection, that familial connection, become a reality, if that makes sense? And then to what extent does, like, I'm trying to extend this metaphor, does like a deportation like the revelation of the lie, the deportation, to what extent does that ruin any kind of progress that drama therapy may have made? Like, I wonder if drama therapy functions because people are aware, like people are able to give consent to that process in it happening.
We should all move to Italy is what I'm getting from your point here, Marta.
Yeah.
We should all move to Italy, guys. This extended metaphor has gone on too long. I'm sorry to anyone who's had to listen to it.
But yeah, I think that is really interesting because, like we mentioned earlier, it would be invasive if they were to find out he were lying. So it is like drama therapy for him. I don't think it's necessarily drama therapy for the family, unless it's in those moments where he's like acting out things with Azza as like George and stuff like that. But like the therapist utilizes drama therapy at the beginning when he's like pretending to be Bedros, like he's pretending to be the son, and George kind of like freaks out. I think that was traumatizing for George. So I do think maybe it is just drama therapy for the characters who are aware of it, because I don't think that family would be okay with that.
But then ironically, to what extent does it actually become drama therapy when Peter is lying to them? Because the therapist attempts to consensually act out a position as their child, and that fails because they are aware of the fact that it is fake. But when they're not aware of the fact that it's fake, then like, does it actually become some form of therapy? Like, does it actually help them as long as the illusion remains in place? I think that's probably an interesting question to explore, even if it obviously is unethical.
Yeah, I think that is interesting because I feel like one of the main reasons it failed in the therapist office is because George had such a resistance to it, probably out of his pride, right? Like a reluctance to show his emotion, which is probably, I'm assuming, what Peter caught on to, was that like if George were made aware, he wouldn't participate.
Mm-hmm. And because of that illusion, it was able to yield success. At least we could hope so, because we never really know how that turns out. But I think the optimist in all of us would like to think that the illusion remains and that Peter is able to bring the family together. And with that, we bring our episodes together as well. So Adam Agoyan, if you happen to be listening, we hope you enjoyed our dissection of your first feature. And thank you so much, Marta and Sophie, for this great conversation.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks so much for listening to our conversation. For more information on all of SVC's activities, including our past journal publications and upcoming club meeting information, check out the link to our website in the episode description. I'd like to thank the Victoria University Student Administrative Council, VUSAC, and the University of Toronto Students' Union, UTSU, for their continued support of our club, Screenwriting at Victoria College. Finally, I want to give a big shout out to the entire podcast team. Our audio editor, Corinne Langmuir, our writing and research team, Nujat Thabassum and Kaylin Ball, our content coordinator, Connie Zeng, and finally, our content head and co-host, Marta Anielska. This has been Vikram Majawan. Fade to Black.